Welcome to Fresnolandia. I'm Jordan Maddox.
I'm Donnie Bergstrom.
This week on Fresnolandia, we're going to be doing a news roundup. There's been a lot of things going on in Fresno. We're going to cover a bunch of different topics. We've got Rob Parsons here, as well as my co-host, Daniel Bergstrom. We're going to start with the Prop 50 voter guide. For those who don't know, Prop 50 is the proposal to essentially, how should we say it?
Rob?
Gerrymander.
Thank you. I was going to say, Rob is a fan of using the word gerrymander.
Okay, so we need to be clear about our terms. Okay, what's included in this Prop 50 voter guide and how will it help people make their decisions when it comes to the ballot?
Want to go big picture?
Yeah, might as well. So while we call it gerrymandering, the Newsom camp calls it the Election Rigging Response Act, which is a clever name.
It's a mouthful.
It is a mouthful. And for those of you who haven't listened to our podcast on Proposition 50, which I highly recommend to go really deep into the weeds on this, but basically Proposition 50 is Governor Newsom's response to the redistricting gerrymandering efforts happening in Texas to turn at least six congressional districts in Texas to tilt more favorably towards Republicans. They're doing this because typically in midterm elections, there's often when there's a Republican incumbent, there's a switch to Democrats in the congressional races and vice versa. So they're trying to protect against that. And so this is Newsom's response. Proposition 50 would basically create six more competitive seats for Democrats as opposed to what we have now and probably shift the maps. There's a lot of changes in Central Valley districts, most notably Fresno County would go from having four to six congressional districts. We'd share more of our congressional districts with the Bay Area, the North Valley in particular, and you would see more of an alignment of urban districts as opposed to rural districts, and a lot of people in rural communities have thoughts about that. Maybe unsurprisingly, you have a lot of opponents to the gerrymandering effort in Fresno County from most of our boards of supervisors to the Farm Bureau opposing it. On the pro side, you know, it's pretty partisan. You have a lot of Democrats supporting it. Notably in Fresno, you have Fresno City Council Member Miguel Arias supporting it.
What is the con side saying? What's their argument against Prop 50?
We have an independent redistricting commission in California. It is highly esteemed. There is a clear process, and this basically wipes out all of the efforts that we've had over the last couple of decades to have a more independent process.
And do they bring up Texas at all in their opposition to Prop 50, or is that
treated
as its own separate subject?
Correct.
Okay. All right. And the people for it, how do they answer the response from the con side about getting rid of the independent redistricting commission?
There seems to be a grit our teeth and bear it perspective from the liberals on this issue. I think the most common refrain I've heard is, this is the only way to stop GOP gerrymandering. We must do it back to them.
We have an electoral gun to our head, if you will.
Absolutely. And there's merit to that argument. I think just objectively, they are gerrymandering in Texas for the benefit of the Republican Party, not for the benefit of the voters in Texas. And you've got the President of the United States and a Republican governor in Texas who have decided that what's best for the country in their view is to essentially cut out some Texas voters because of how they vote. And the Democratic response in California is to steal that plan and do it back to them. And we have many conservative and Republican Californians that will absolutely have their votes watered down, counted out, and this will be very bad news long term, I think, for minority voter parties in every state. I think it sets a very troubling precedent. I don't think I'm speaking out of school when I say that. I think it's fairly obvious that voting districts should be drawn for the interests of the voters and not for the interests of these two parties, but this is where we're at. And I don't think either side has done a very good job of acknowledging the pain that they will be causing for minority party voters across the aisle.
Another potential victim here is rural communities, right? Because it's shifting a lot
1,000%
of power to urban. What could we expect would change for rural communities if this went through?
Beyond just having less of a coalition, I think that the interests, ostensibly the Farm Bureau is opposed to this because ag interests are going to get diluted. So that's a big piece of this. But rural interests are not necessarily ag interests. There's also a lot of rural community interests, disinvestment in places like Huron, Mendota, San Joaquin, et cetera. And so when they lose representation, when they're fragmented, they don't have a stronger voice that's saying, hey, we need to see more investment in water infrastructure in these places or investment in housing infrastructure. It just gets tilted more towards urban communities.
Okay. Switching gears here, we are seeing waves and waves of ICE arrests across the country, and we're seeing them here in Fresno outside of courtrooms, to be specific. What's happened in the last week or so around ICE activity in Fresno?
As always has been the case over the last year or so on federal immigration issues, it's been very hard to get a very accurate picture of exactly what the situation is on the ground. Primarily, in my view, as a journalist, that's because we're not getting good information from the federal government, good, reliable information from the federal government. So we have relied more often on multiple accounts from immigrant groups, trying to just verify with as many sources as possible, people on the ground. And yeah, some of those groups last week, I believe on Wednesday, organized a peaceful protest outside the federal courthouse here in Fresno. Fresno's Omar Rashad went down and spoke with them. And there's a real sense of fear, a real sense of desperation, and almost not hopelessness, because the point of the rally was to show people how they could protect their rights and fight back. But there's a real sense of almost depression or a sense of impending doom almost around these. I'm talking a little too dark.
I think the reality is that we're not seeing federal agents following law or established protocols.
And I think that the Supreme Court, I believe, is getting ready to weigh in on this issue of racial profiling again. But they have, at least temporarily since, I believe, September, allowed ICE to stop, detain, and arrest people without warrants based completely on the color of their skin. And there's not really a good answer for what people are supposed to do and how they're supposed to combat that when the Supreme Court essentially okays racial profiling. And so we're seeing more of these kinds of protests. We're seeing more even here in Fresno. We're not getting a lot of the big national headlines are focused on Chicago and Portland and LA for some very obvious
national
reasons.
Guard,
that's where the Trump administration is focused. But the impacts in places like Fresno are very real and really easy to miss because they happen to individual parents. They happen to, we're arresting grocery store clerks now and restaurant store managers. These are not the worst of the worst like we were promised. And I think people are searching for answers. And I do feel like we're starting to get more and more groups coming together and pushing back in different ways and maybe more forcefully or aggressively in terms of rhetoric than we have seen in the past.
I see. And are ICE tactics evolving? Are we seeing different things here in Fresno and other places that we need to be aware of?
I think we've seen a lot of the same things that have been reported in multiple communities. Fresno Land has previously reported on masked federal agents that we were later able to identify as ICE or Border Patrol. We still have masked, unmarked agents sometimes grabbing people out of courthouses or off the courthouse, and it's not always immediately clear what's happening. I think a lot of people can understand the idea that those are probably federal agents, but I think if you go back and you look at, I think especially to Omar Rashad captured some video, I believe, in July of this happening in Fresno. And unless you're told those are federal agents, they could just be four guys.
Yeah, we talked about vigilantes on a previous podcast where this kind of activity kind of gives license to people to engage outside of the law.
It's very scary.
Yeah.
Yeah. In the article, the immigrants' rights groups are calling for members of the community to get involved. How should people or could people get involved in supporting their fellow community members who are at risk of detention?
I think the biggest thing is they want people to know their rights. If you are undocumented or have an undocumented family member, coworker, if people in your network know what you can and can't do if you are in the face of immigration enforcement. They also have a Valley Watch Network hotline to report any potential sightings of federal immigration enforcement. And there's a phone number, 559-206-0151, to connect with the network if you see immigration enforcement. Those calls really help. They do a lot of verification to make sure that people aren't just phoning in phony calls. But that helps people understand how ICE is operating and moving within the community, because like Rob said earlier, we're just not getting a lot of great information from the feds about how these enforcement stings are operated.
Okay. As a lot of the ICE activity is heating up, the Fresno Madera housing boom is cooling off, If you drive up the 41 outside of Fresno past Children's Hospital, you probably noticed huge developments on the rise out there, Riverstone, Tesoro Viejo, but it's cooling off. What's happening out
there? It's my fault.
Rob did it.
It's my fault.
Yeah.
No, Greg Weaver has a great story out last week about this, and to some degree, it is my fault. Greg points out in the story that one of the reasons that unsold houses are piling up for the first time in years is because guys like me who bought a house 5 or so years ago secured an interest rate that was about 3%.
That COVID refinance.
You can take my 2% interest rate out of my cold dead hand. And I'm never selling.
This is a sensitive point for me, but we won't talk about it.
And so that's where my wife and I are at right now, is we're not going to sell our house and pick up a higher interest rate somewhere else. Why would we? And we're not alone in this kind of problem. And it's created this new wrinkle now where we're trying to build our way out of a housing crisis and a homelessness crisis. And now the housing market is also freezing because nobody wants to flip homes anymore.
Yeah.
And on the other end of that, you also see a slowdown in new construction sales too, because there's this other part of the market slowdown, which is that people just don't have the money.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
There is demand for housing, but the price points are too high. And as Greg reported, the Fresno average is hovering at around $500,000, which is wild to me as a person who's lived here for most of my life.
Yeah, it seems like there's a strange dialectic, because we talk about, you know, how tight the housing market is in Fresno, but then we're also talking about a boom cooling off. And so, Donnie, how do you square that circle between those two things?
If you read Greg's story, a lot of the boom that we saw in the 2020s really was about, at least anecdotally, from a lot of people moving here from the Bay Area or LA with a remote job. That was certainly how I got back to Fresno. I was a Bay Area resident, came back here because I had a job that could be remote, although that was way before 2020. And so people came back here with Bay Area salaries, could easily afford a $500,000, $600,000 house. And that trend, as we're seeing a lot more return to office policies being enacted across this country, people don't have that flexibility anymore. And so sure enough, when you look at the actual demand of people who are longer term residents of Fresno Madera, like, most of us can't afford $500,000, $600,000 homes.
How will this cool off affect the Fresno rental market potentially?
Our rental market remains one of the tightest in the country.
Will it be more tight now because people have less money to buy new homes and then they're
looking for
rental properties? Yeah.
And we're not seeing, I don't follow this as closely on a monthly basis, but the last time I checked, I mean, the pace at which we are building new apartments is not going up. And this is, and you talk to developers who build apartments and they have tons of reasons why that's the case. Part of it is interest rates for them to secure financing are high, so it's not easy for them to build. And they also have to, because the supply chain, inflation, the cost of construction have gone up, they have to then charge higher rents to recoup their cost of construction. And those rents are often out of reach for most people in the market.
But we're also seeing housing prices starting to decline, as it talks about in the article, about over 5% over the last year. Will that help?
5% is a small margin. If you're talking about moving 5% off of $500,000, does that open up that much more?
$490,000 versus $500,000.
Right, yeah. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Like, the affordable home for a person with an average wage in Fresno is closer to $300,000, in the low 300s or so. Probably not going to see a lot of change right now.
Yeah, I hope what doesn't happen is what the last line of the article says. We might become, quote, the next Rust Belt. Hopefully not. But a fascinating story that you should read when you have the time. Let's talk about the West Fresno Community College campus. They're working on a memory collection. Donnie, what's going on in West Fresno?
Yeah, Juliana had a nice story out last week about this. Fresno City College has a West Fresno campus that opened a couple of years ago, and they have a public art project they're working on where they want to create a large memory quilt that's made out of sculpted materials, and it's comprising of memories of West Fresno over the decades. And in the research phase of their project, the artists that they were working with realized that there's just not a ton of archived history about West Fresno, and which is a huge bummer. And obviously,
which is also normative too, and I just want to say this, a lot of historical societies, through no fault of their own, tend to focus on wealthy families and the history of a city, because often those are the people that had the most things preserved, had the most photographs because they could afford to purchase them, had people collect their items for them. But the downside is a lot of people get lost in time and we don't hear those stories because they weren't well documented.
There's a really cool anecdote in Juliana's story about this guy named Napoleon. And he was a fixture in the 80s and 90s, I believe, in West Fresno. And this is a community, historic Black community, has increasingly become Latino and Asian, but did not for decades have its own grocery store. I think the first grocery store in West Fresno opened in 2000.
Whoa.
Yeah, no, it was pretty bad, redlining, all of the things that contributed to that. And so this guy, Napoleon, would drive around and go door to door and sell fresh produce and fruits and vegetables to people. And he was like a beloved person in the community. And they were realizing, like, we know, everyone knows who Napoleon is, but no one has a photo of him.
Yeah,
no
you
one,
need artifacts in
right.
order to retain that.
And
yeah.
so the story came out, and I actually had someone text me on Friday after the story came out, and they found a picture of Napoleon. And it was
awesome.
So cool to see that.
That's amazing.
And so anyways, all of this to say, West Fresno campus is crowdsourcing images, any sort of artifacts from the community. And so if you have any information that you want to contribute to this project, please send it to the artists that are involved. It's in the story. Just look it up on our website to get the details.
Is there a date when they're going to unveil all of this or an insight to the project?
It's still pretty early days. And as Juliana reports there, this crowdsourced or community survey, they didn't have an exact deadline for when they were going to close that off or stop accepting submissions. But they said around mid-October is when they're hoping to get enough submissions underway. So the clock is ticking. If you have photos or if you have stories or artifacts that you think might be relevant, they would absolutely love to hear from you. But if you get it in, I would assume if you came in third week of October or first week of November even, I'm sure people would still love to hear accounts.
Miguel Arias, city councilman from District 1, who's going to be leaving office. And so who are our candidates to replace Councilman Arias?
Yeah, so the two frontrunners are Assembly Member Dr. Joaquin Arambula, who is stepping in to potentially, or is to run for the seat, and Keisha Thomas, who currently represents the area on the Fresno Unified Board of Trustees.
Do we typically see assembly persons
No.
step into a city council role?
This is something you would see more in LA, certainly, or the Bay Area, where in weirdly, the state legislature is the starting place for a person's local career.
Interesting.
And you saw that with Antonio Villaraigosa, who we had up in Fresno recently. He was the speaker of the assembly before he even stepped into the mayor's race back in LA.
So the bigger the city, the more prestige with the job. But,
yeah.
But around here, that's interesting that
it's all about the number of people you represent. And so I think that, please don't quote me. Being quoted, I'm on a podcast, but so excuse me for speaking out of my head for a second, but I'm pretty sure the assembly has a little bit more people that it represents compared to a Fresno City Council district, but it's not a huge differential where like the mayor of Fresno would be a step up from the assembly because you're representing more people.
I see. So we've got two front runners.
Yeah, so there's a couple of big issues that popped off at this forum, which was held at the Westside Church of God last week that Pablo on our team reported on. The Southwest Pacific Plan is a big issue for a lot of folks in the community, and that's really about a zoning dispute that we've reported on consistently over the last few years. Basically, the residents want to make sure that there's not additional industrial uses that are brought into the community, but the heavy industrial uses that have been in the community over time are over time phased out. So that's a big deal for them. Housing, of course, came up, making sure that there is both a good balance of affordable and market rate housing. Historically, Southwest Fresno has been the place that most public and affordable housing has gone, and residents for a long time have said, we want market rate housing, we want investment, we want private investment, not just public investment in our community. So that was another big topic that came up.
Fantastic.
City council year next year. Four city council seats will be up on a ballot next year.
It's next year is the odds. Districts 1357.
1357. Okay.
Yeah. So one is the seat that is Tower District in West Central Fresno, currently represented by Annalisa Perea. She is also running for state assembly right now, so she will not be running, although she's termed out for that seat. And then 5 is Southeast Fresno, so that's Brandon Vang's seat. That was a special election, so he'll be on the ballot again, and I'm not entirely sure who's going to be running against him for that seat. And then 7 is like Central East Fresno, so that's the district currently held by Nelson Esparza, and there's a couple of candidates who have jumped in the ring for that.
Yeah.
So that's potentially the balance of power on the ballot.
Yeah, which of those seats do you think is going to be most contentious in the election? What would you predict, Rob and Donnie?
All of them.
All of them?
That's going to be a pretty...
I think
all of them will have some flashpoints to them?
I know for... I don't know yet who has emerged to run in 5 against Brandon Vang, so that one is a question mark, but there are... In District 3, you have Assemblymember Rambula and Keisha Thomas, and I think that will be a... interesting race to watch. In District 1, you have a couple of people who have jumped in the race. You have Myra Campa, who currently works for Annalisa Perea. You have Deep Singh, who runs Jakara Movement. You have Rob Fuentes, who's on the State Senator Community College District Board. So you have some people who have a little bit of name recognition already. And then in District 7, you have Nav Gurm, who's like a local Dem political operative who's worked for a lot of candidates. You have Ariana Martinez-Lott, who also works for Miguel Arias and has been a community organizer for many years. In District 7, you have Nav Gurm, who is a Democratic political operative, an attorney. He's worked for a couple of candidates already. You have Ariana Martinez-Lott, who also worked for Miguel Arias on the city council and has been a community organizer for many years. And then you have AJ Rasamni, who is the head of the Blackstone Merchants Association. And so that one will also be, I think, a pretty intense race as well.
Okay. To close, what's on the horizon here in Fresno, both politically and in the community? What do we need to be watching out for over the next few weeks?
Two things I'm watching out for in October. One is the West Area Specific Plan. Listeners of this podcast know I'm a land use nerd and an urban planner, and that is a plan for all of the neighborhoods west of 99, north of 180, that has been worked on close to a decade, I want to say, and has had some issues getting across the finish line, and it's basically a master plan to make sure that the neighborhoods that are growing west of the 99 are growing in a cohesive, smart way and have a good balance of housing and retail and parks and schools. A lot of the residents west of 99 have been asking for this plan to get done for a long time because it's, in their view, has been seen as the barrier for private investment, especially retail. Like, I don't think there are many grocery stores west of 99. If you drive west of 99, the streets are super wonky and you'll go from...
It's a strange place.
It is very strange.
Yeah, yeah. Like, when I go out there, I'm just looking for like a central point to understand a community, but I can't find it. It's patchwork.
And a lot of those neighborhoods developed prior to the housing crash of 2008. And then when 2008 hit, it was like an abrupt halt. And so you can see how time and the length of time it's taken to really build that out has really made it just a really chaotic place. And so anyways, residents are hoping the plan gets done. The other big thing on the radar for me in October is Measure C. This is the big month for all of the negotiations around how much money goes to roads versus to transit versus to bike lanes. That's all going to get resolved in the next few weeks. So there will be more to come on that.
We close these podcasts every week with what we're loving this week. Donnie, there was a big release this last week. And I'm not being enigmatic intentionally, but if you're a regular listener, you should know what
you
I'm referring.
You should know I'm a Swiftie. I don't hide it anymore. Yes, Life of a Showgirl came out on Friday. I went and saw the movie with some friends on Friday night.
So what are our thoughts? Give us summative thoughts about the movie, the album.
I have not read a ton of the hot takes on the internet, in part because I want to get my own opinion about it and without listening. Because a lot of people were really critical of Tortured Poets, and I loved that from first listen. I did not love this on first listen. I think Sonically, it's different than what I expected. I was told I was going to get Swedish pop bangers that I can go on a dance floor and dance to, and I don't really feel like that's what this is. It's
what is it? How would you describe it? What's its log line? What's this album doing?
It has very much of a 1960s, 1970s feel to it. I think there's a little bit of ABBA influence or Motown influence in it as well. And not that's bad, it's just not, I wanted synthy, like Ace of Base type Robin Swedish pop, and that's not the kind of Swedish pop I got.
Interesting. So what, because her albums are so autobiographical, what does this tell you about where she is?
It's lovey poppy, I love Travis, and this is how much I love my life with Travis. That's a lot of the album, and that so doesn't bother me. Like a lot of people who want Taylor to be like the angsty? Have the most feminist takes of all time, I think, are a little frustrated. And I just don't expect that.
Yeah. She's in domestic bliss. So she's just basking in it.
Yeah. And I am of the mind that you can have domestic bliss and bake bread and love being with your partner and also be a feminist.
Yeah.
Those are not.
Be angry while you bake bread. And then yes. I'll introduce you to Alison LeClaire.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that a lot of people also expected her to have more of a political take on the current moment that we're in, and I just don't expect my pop stars to always do that for me. Like, I get that in other places.
Yeah. So mid for you.
Yeah.
Mid.
Okay. Yes.
Rob, what are you loving this week?
I have a completely different direction. I'm not loving anything that's new or original or even very creative. I love the Taco Bell Breakfast Crunchwrap Supreme. Bacon specifically. If anyone can call in and tell me or write in and tell me what kind of bacon that is, because I think it's just bacon bits.
Yeah. So it's not strips. We're talking little chunks.
Yeah. Of probably bacon adjacent meat, okay. I would say.
Bacon like substance.
Yeah. And it's so good.
Do you think that you could recreate it at home and do it better? Yeah.
No, I think if you used better ingredients, it would taste wrong.
Yeah, so you like tasting the chemistry, if you will, of what they're doing in those labs far away.
You say it like that. Yes.
Okay. Well, know thyself, right?
Yeah. I don't know. I was just having a weird moment this weekend, and I found myself reading an old Shel Silverstein book and eating a Bacon Crunchwrap Supreme on a beach. And
wow, that's a poetic
scene.
It was one of the better mornings of my life. I'm just going to put that out there.
So just some nostalgia road for you.
Yeah, absolutely. If someone can tell me what's in the Bacon Crunchwrap Supreme, I would love to know.
Yeah, probably some things with lots of X's, Y's, and Z's, lots of additives. But if it tastes good. What I'm loving this week is similar to Donnie, one of my cultural heroes, Paul Thomas Anderson, just released a new movie last week. It's called One Battle After Another. It's a movie he's been working on for 20 years and couldn't be more relevant, strangely. It starts at an immigration detention facility with a leftist group essentially blowing parts of it up and releasing people. And then it turns into a movie about a father-daughter relationship, a whole lot more. But it's a really powerful and incredible movie. And like a lot of film nerds, we've been spending a lot of time trying to create our Paul Thomas Anderson like ranking, because this is his 10th movie. And so there's a lot of people just making lists. And for me, I haven't landed where it's at, but it's
top 10.
Top 3 or 4.
Have you talked to my husband about this yet?
No, has he seen it yet?
Oh, are you kidding me?
Oh, he saw it already. Okay.
He's eating up every little bit of analysis of this on the internet at the moment.
Yes. I went and saw it with my friend Vince Mancini, who's a great local writer. Has a great story about taco trucks in Fresno, if you're ever looking to read something interesting about where you live. And we just didn't say a word when we walked out of the movie. We finally got to the parking lot, and we both were like, that was mostly a perfect movie, wasn't it? And we agreed that's where it was. So I would encourage you to see it in IMAX. It's not often that we get just like a movie release like this that just so captured the moment and is also just a perfect piece of art. And yeah, this is beyond loving for me this week. This was euphoric in a lot of ways, getting to see this in theaters. So yeah, that's what I'm loving this week.
I have to grab some Crunchwrap Supremes and go see it.
This has been Fresnolandia. I'm Jordan Maddox.
I'm Donnie Bergstrom. And this podcast was recorded at Sun Stereo Warehouse in downtown Fresno. Audio editing and mixing was done by Jordan Maddox. Our lead image comes from Vaughn Ballinan. And our song comes from Stateless Rat.